Because pro sports is a multi-billion dollar industry in this country, not to mention the millions of amateurs who compete at school or recreationally, there's been a ton of research into what athletes need to stay healthy and perform at their best. But sports medicine, as we know it today, emerged at a time when doctors thought too much running around could make your uterus fall out. So the field is only now starting to grapple with the ways that biologically male and female bodies are alike and different. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Turns out bodies may respond differently to certain nutrients based on sex. They may be vulnerable to different kinds of injuries in the same sport and may face different pressures in youth to either grow fast or delay development. And understanding these differences will benefit athletes of all genders more than any one-size-fits-all set of recommendations. Christine Yu is a journalist and author of the book Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. Christine, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
As this exercise physiologist you spoke with noted, women are not small men. This is obvious to pretty much anyone who is human. So why for a long time did science assume women and men were biologically identical aside from our reproductive organs to the extent that the research looked only at male bodies?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of reasons, right? If we look back to, you know, how sports was developed, sports was very much, and still is really, frankly, a male-dominated domain, right? It's where men went to test their masculinity, to prove their power, their dominance. And it's always been this realm in which, you know, male bodies have been prioritized, if you will. And similarly with science, especially the sports science field, it has primarily evolved around, men scientists in the labs who are conducting the research. And then if they are studying, you know, athletes, who are they going to then go and choose, right? You know, the bulk of the pool of the potential participants are these male athletes. But, you know, pulling back the curtain a little bit more, right, when scientists are interested in investigating something, they, you know, they're looking at, say, like a specific hormone or a specific chemical reaction, or how, you know, what giving someone this one supplement might impact, you know, something else. And in order to do that, they need to remove as many confounding variables as possible. They need to minimize the amount of noise so that they can see, you know, does something have an impact, or how, you know, this molecular mechanism works. And so when you, from their perspective, when you look at women, women are kind of, we're kind of messy, right? Only in the sense that we have a menstrual cycle, we have these fluctuating hormones that, you know, spike and dip and move all around throughout the month, and therefore add a lot of noise to the data. So when they're thinking about doing a scientific experiment, they're like, well, it's just easier to study men in a lot of ways, right? You don't have to then account for all these other, this other fluctuation potentially in the background that could influence the studies that they're doing. So it kind of, you know, in a way became a little bit of a, you know, a shortcut, if you will, to keep things easier, to keep things simple and less expensive. But it then becomes the standard. That becomes the standard methodology that people pass on, you know, to their students, and then those students pass on to their students. And it, in a way, such that we don't even realize, right, that we're not studying women.
What's so interesting is that at the same time we assumed we could know what we needed to know about human exercise physiology by studying predominantly men, and we should note predominantly white men, there were also these weird unscientific assumptions that women couldn't or shouldn't be athletes. What were some of the reasons we were told not to do a lot of exercise?
Yeah, it is this kind of weird, you know, contradiction, right? So reasons ranged from, I think you mentioned things like our uterus, like the belief that our uterus would fall out or our ovaries would burst if we did too much high impact sport. There's the one of the prevailing beliefs is that physical activity would harm the reproductive system. And if you go back in time, right, that frankly was the main important role for women in society is to reproduce. So anything that was considered potentially a threat or a harm to that reproductive system, you know, that women weren't encouraged to do. There was a physician in Boston, his name was Edward Clark, who wrote this whole book about, basically his point was, is that the menstrual cycle sapped extra energy from women. So because of that, because women had less energy, we shouldn't do more anything else on top of that, right? So that included everything from, like, maybe women shouldn't be educated or have as strenuous of an education as boys. And for sure, you know, women shouldn't be exercising. And so these myths, you know, a lot of these myths persist. And it really, you know, if you think about it too, it wasn't until 2014 Winter Olympics that women were allowed to ski jump. And at the time, you know, the person who was in charge of the International Ski Federation, I mean, essentially said that the concern was, is that the impact from landing, from doing ski jumps, could harm women's bodies.
What's interesting is that it occurred to nobody that men running and jumping around or cycling 200 miles might damage their fertility prospects.
No. And again, I think it goes back to this idea that that's who's, like, sport was developed in the model of men or for men, right? So it was always assumed that sport was good for this population of people, that they were made to do sport. And if men were made to do sport, right, then when you look at women, then you think about all the ways in which women were different or didn't match up to that male model, if you will, right? And then you start to think of women's bodies as, well, there's got to be something wrong with them. There's got to be something that's deficient or not as good, because even when you look at something like injury rates, right? So when we notice that there are disparities in injuries between men and women, again, we go back to this idea, well, men aren't getting injured. So what's wrong or different about women's bodies that are making them more injury prone? And so it's this kind of subconscious narrative that I think we're all fed.
There is the factor that protective equipment is typically designed around male bodies. How much does that contribute to the disparity in injury rates?
Oh, it could very well, right, contribute a lot. I haven't seen specific studies looking at that in particular, but from a lot of anecdotal evidence and from, you know, women that I've talked to and interviewed, it 100% affects their comfort and their ability, right, to play sport. So if you think about something like soccer cleats, soccer's, right, a pretty popular sport, especially among women and girls. We've seen such a huge interest in women's soccer, but up until recently, there hasn't been a soccer cleat or, you know, shoe that has been made specifically for women. So there are some anatomical differences in a woman's foot, not only in terms of the shape of the foot, but potentially in terms of how, you know, loading happens and where those pressure points are. But there wasn't a shoe that was made in, you know, for women. And so women, even at the professional level, were stuck with mostly wearing, like, men's shoe, or even if it was considered unisex, I mean, frankly, it was still a man's shoe, or if they had smaller feet, they were wearing kids' shoes. But if you're not comfortable in your shoe, that can, and you're getting blisters, or, you know, it's not loading correctly or putting additional pressure points on your foot, it could absolutely lead to injury, right? It could lead to more fatigue, which could then lead to, that's a factor in injury. So there are a lot of these issues that, frankly, we haven't even considered or really thought about.
So why even today is it easier to find men to volunteer for exercise science research than women?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question. And I there's not a good base of research on this, but, you know, people think that there might be some volunteer bias in terms of who chooses to participate in studies like sports science studies. So these studies aren't just you go into a room and fill out a survey or something like that. It involves you potentially, obviously exercising or doing some sort of physical activity. It might involve blood draws. It might involve, some change to your diet or nutrition. It's involved, right? Like, it's not just a simple thing. So there might be some bias in terms of who is actually coming forward to say, hey, I'll do this study for you. Some think that men might be, might be one reason why men are more prevalent is because men might be more willing to do that. Women might be more risk adverse in terms of taking part of these studies. Women might frankly have more responsibilities outside of, work or just work and having their time in their schedule to come out because they're caring for kids, they're caring for older parents, they're doing a million other things, right? So that could be a factor. So while some of the methodology 100%, is built in a way that does prioritize men, it's not just, a fault of any one scientist or any one scientific institution. I think that there's a variety of things in the system that might be contributing to it.
Women athletes in particular, women and girls, may face relentless pressure to reduce their body fat percentages in order, they're told, to perform at peak levels. Of course, even very fit women naturally are going to have more body fat than fit men. Are we still making the mistake there of assuming that what works for men works for women?
100%, because we've had this one standard of athletic development, and that standard, like I said, has been largely, it's been based on men because that's where our studies are, that's where most of the athletes are, and we continually compare girls and women to that same standard and hold them to that same standard. And so when girls and women don't perform the same way, when they get injured, when they frankly burn out, because they keep pushing their bodies and in order to try to stay on this one trajectory, they're made to feel like they did something wrong. There's something wrong with their bodies and that why isn't it performing the way that it should? I think one of the places where we see this the most is in adolescence, because, like I said, boys seem to develop along a straight line. It's pretty stepwise progression generally for the most part. While girls, because yes, we're growing taller, but our hips are widening, we're growing breasts, we're dealing with hormonal fluctuations in the ways that the boys aren't. And so it's no wonder that girls start to feel a little bit more clumsy or awkward in their body. It takes time to get used to that body. So it's no wonder that athletic progression looks different. It stalls, it dips, it kinks, it kind of goes, feels like it goes around in circles. But we don't give girls that grace of time and patience so that they can just get used to their maturing bodies.
What have we learned, Christine, about how male and female bodies might respond differently to diets like keto that strictly limit carbohydrate consumption in favor of fat? What does that mean for athletes?
Sports nutrition, I find, feels like a minefield. It's so confusing. There are so many diet trends and fads, and if you go on social media, you'll see 10 different ways in which you're supposed to eat in order to reach your peak performance. And it's confusing to parse through. One of the, we've seen in the last several years, the rise of the keto diet, in which you're prioritizing, it's a high fat diet, right? So I think of it as flipping the p food pyramid on its head a little bit, right? So you're getting a lot of fat, very little carbohydrates, as well as things like intermittent fasting, where you are essentially not eating for, anywhere between, 10 to 14 hours, say. And then that's supposed to prime your body to perform better. And so what the research has actually found is that For something like intermittent fasting, men, appear to maybe do well on that type of diet. They, their bodies can still perform well, and it's not detrimental to them. What they found with women is that is the opposite, is that women actually perform better when we're in a fed state. So when we have enough energy on board, consistent energy, to fuel our bodies in order to do what it needs to do. And so some of the thinking around this is that women's bodies are much more sensitive to any downturn in energy, right? So any point in which our bodies feel like it does not have enough energy to support not only, the activities of daily life, but to support your training and exercise. Some of the thought has to be is that it does have to do with the fact that our bodies are made to potentially have a baby and carry a pregnancy to term. So, any downturn in energy might signal that there's not enough food around. So this isn't a good time to have a baby, right? And so because of that downturn in energy, we start to see fluctuate, suppression of hormones. You start to see suppression of the menstrual cycle, and that causes a whole cascade of changes physiologically that not only could potentially affect sports performance and your ability to adapt to training, but again, long-term health.
Christine, we should talk here about breasts, which are a physical characteristic that, for the most part, women athletes have to deal with that is really not a consideration for most male athletes. How much progress has been made toward creating bras that really work for athletes?
Not much. I mean, I think we are starting to get there. I laugh because, like you said, like breasts aren't a consideration for men. And I think for so long, it's just assumed that they're almost these extraneous appendages, if you will, right? So we don't, why would we need to pay attention to them when we're talking about something like sports? But for anyone who does have breasts, you know that a sports bra is an essential piece of athletic gear. Breast pain and tenderness and everything that goes along with it is one of the biggest barriers to physical activity and sport. I think it was like one in two adolescent girls cited that as a reason why, they're not active. And yet the sports bra wasn't invented until 1977, even though it was the height of the jogging boom, right? But there was no good solution for controlling breast movement during that time. So women would wear like two bras on top of each other, or a smaller size bra. But even after that initial sports bra was designed and we started to see more products on the market, it really wasn't until the 2000s, 2010s, where scientists actually started to really not pay attention, but really be able to study in a meaningful way the way that breasts move with physical activity. So if we want to be able to design a good sports bra, one that's comfortable, one that, controls movement in a good way, you need to be able to study how breasts actually move in order to design that garment. So it was, again, it wasn't until this, not so long ago that there was actually the technology for biomechanics to be able to see what that pattern of movement is like. And so we're starting to see a lot more bras that are on the market, and in development that really incorporate more of this science. And hopefully, that will get us better sports bras, not too far off in the future.
Is that science being funded at like the university level, or is this the kind of thing that's still happening like in the design studios at Lululemon?
So there are a lot there. Some of the biggest breast biomechanics labs are at universities, but the brands themselves recognize that this is important. So they are actually partnering with these universities, oftentimes to do testing at all stages of the design process, right? From the beginning, through prototyping, through, when they have final products and whatnot. So which is really encouraging, right? That these companies are recognizing that this is a need. We need to invest in this. We need to do this. And they're partnering with the people who are able to do that.
What do we know, Christine, about different vulnerabilities that women and men might have to musculoskeletal injuries and what the mechanisms might be behind that?
Yeah, so there, I think two of the areas, to actually three areas where we see kind of pretty big disparities are around concussion, traumatic knee injuries, so things like ACL tears, as well as bone stress injuries. I think we hear most about the concussions and the ACL tears, and the, you know, even especially these days with the World Cup coming up, and there are so many players in the last couple months that have had ACL tears. And so when we look at these disparities, we see that, you know, I'm just going to talk about the knee injuries. We see that women are 2 to 8 times more likely to suffer from a tear compared to a man. So again, it begs the question, when researchers and doctors start to look at this, they want to know, what is it that could potentially put women at greater risk for this? And so they start to, again, kind of compare men's and women's bodies, thinking, you know, if men aren't getting injured, then maybe they're more durable. So what is it about women's bodies that is less durable, and what's different? And so, you know, we often hear about things like, well, it's because of wider hips and the Q angle of our, you know, from of our thigh bone to our knee that puts additional stress through the knee. That's why, you know, we are more susceptible. There are, you know, evidence that the menstrual cycle may affect it in terms of hormone levels. So when estrogen is higher, the ligament might be more lax, therefore it might be more prone to injury. But in recent years, what researchers have started to look at is, you know, stepping back and looking at the greater environment around these athletes. So sure, there might be some physiological or anatomical reasons why women theoretically could be more prone to injury. But frankly, you know, as a girl or a woman, like, that's pretty depressing in the sense that there's nothing you can do about that, right? That's your physiology. So as researchers have started to pull back a little bit, they've noticed that maybe it also has to do with the environment. You know, even something as simple as strength, that's often considered, you know, a risk factor because, again, boys and men tend to have more muscle mass than women. But are the girls and women actually being encouraged to go to the gym and work out and to build muscle that could potentially help make their bodies more resilient? So that's one factor. Another factor might be, are we teaching, you know, especially our kids and girls, how to use and move their bodies in a way that, again, they understand how their body moves. They understand, like, they have a better perception of their body movement and body awareness that could potentially protect them from injury. So there's research done with dancers who, you know, dancers leap, they jump on one leg, those same sort of actions that could potentially lead to an ACL tear. And yet within dance, we don't see that same disparity in knee injuries between boys and girls. So researchers wanted to know why. And when they tested some of these dancers in the lab by having them, you know, basically kind of drop off a tall box and land on one leg, they saw that the boys and girls landed similarly. They used similar strategies to stabilize themselves when they landed on the ground. When they looked at team sports players, the boys, team sports players, used a similar strategy in terms of stabilizing their bodies, but the girl team sports players didn't. They, you know, there was more wobble, their knee kind of fell in, they weren't recruiting the same muscle, there was more stress therefore coming up through their knee. So the hypothesis, it could be, well, those girl dancers, right, those dancers are learning from a very young age how to dance, how to land, how to jump. Are we not doing that also for other girls?
How might different phases of the menstrual cycle affect how hard exercise feels? And are contemporary women athletes learning to kind of work with those cycles rather than in defiance of them?
Yeah, this is probably one of the most interesting pieces that has come up. In recent years, there's been a lot more recognition that Like you said, menstrual cycles matter. Our fluctuating hormones matter because those hormones not only kind of coordinate our fertility and reproductive system, but things like estrogen and progesterone have secondary jobs throughout the body. There are receptors for these hormones in, you know, tissues and virtually every other tissue in the body and organ. So it can affect things like how you metabolize carbohydrates or fat, how you put on and maintain muscle. We talked about bone health, gut health. So there's all these other factors in which these hormones might play a difference. And so it's been heartening to see more girls and women, and especially pro athletes, talk more openly about the menstrual cycle and the symptoms of their menstrual cycle, right? So everything from cramps and fatigue. But my concern is that we start to then think about, is there a way to that we can maximize or capitalize on hormonal fluctuation? So if, you know, a high hormone means this, then are there specific activities that we should do to align with that? Or is there a type of food that we should eat to align with that? And similarly, you know, when there's a lower hormone phase. But the truth of the matter is that there's no one guideline or blueprint that applies to everyone, because all of our experience of the menstrual cycle is so individual, right? So I might have symptoms that you don't have, or someone who is my exact age, same day in the cycle, you know, again, we might have totally different experiences of what that menstrual cycle is. So I think the important thing here is that we are talking about it and that we are considering hormones and their potential role, but we don't make it the only thing, right, that matters in terms of how we structure or think about exercise and training, because the reality is we're not just hormones. We're not just, you know, these chemical messengers. There are so many other factors that come into play that, again, affect training, affect recovery, affect performance, from like nutrition to sleep to hydration, that, you know, all play a role.
Christine Yu is a journalist and author of Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. Christine, thanks so much for sharing all of this.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find us wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe, or catch up right at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.